And in that process, I hope to cover the significance of the number four in spiritual ways. So, why do we have four Gospels? Well, we have a number of suggestions. They were written by human authors with different backgrounds and different personalities. One reason why we could have four Gospels. But they give a different perspective. With four different Gospels, we get a different perspective. Each had a different audience, for example, in mind. We know that Luke was a Greek, John was a Jewish, Mark, I'm not sure if he was Jewish, but Mark was a friend of Paul's, and so, you know, we have those different perspectives on the thing. Some people have come up with the idea that the four Gospels are associated with the four beasts of the Apocalypse and of Daniel. They're actually slightly different, but generally they're a man, an eagle, a lion, and an ox. And some people try to put those images into the idea of the four Gospels. Lastly, some people think the reason we have four Gospels is that certain Gospel writers will pick up things that other Gospel writers missed out. For example, if you have a traffic accident that takes place at an intersection, you may have four people at that intersection who will each give you a different perspective on what actually happened at that intersection. And so in those four Gospels, we will have a different perspective of what happened in Jesus' life. And that's why we have four Gospels. Oh no, he's not meant to be here. In 1891, Mary B. Horton came up with her own ideas based on the heavenly doctrines, on the writings. She called her book Gospel Differences. It's very hard, it's obviously been out of print for a long time, it's very hard to get hold of. But Philip, at one stage, actually converted quite a large amount of it, at least half of it or more, into a digital file. So anybody who would like to do a little bit of research on the first half of that book can come and see me, or possibly Philip's still got it on hand, and I'll be happy to give that to them. Now, before you can understand Mary Horton's ideas, you need to have a look at what I call principles, first principles of regeneration, as presented by the writings. Okay, we're going to come back to that diagram. Okay, the writings teach us that we are born with an evil will. It's an own will. We call it a proprium, which means simply own. And this is our evil will. The writings also tell us that that will is encased in an envelope of innocence. So when our children are born to us, we recognise quite quickly that they are independent human beings. But they also have very attractive aspects to their behaviour, aspects that are very endearing. Yes?
Sorry, I just feel a little bit compelled to make a small comment on the term evil, because particularly with a few first-comers in the room, the word evil is often very loaded, and often loaded with a lot of guilt in other areas. And I tend to now prefer to replace that term evil with selfish, or being self-focused. So, inward-looking, as in not accepting the influx from what is good and true. Whereas evil, the terminology, often loaded with an act of doing something that is really bad and wrong. So in that term, I think it's a lot more subtle than that.
So I'm using the word evil and sinful because that's the words the writings use.
Oh, no,
but thanks for that, Paul. But as we go through it, I hope that you will begin to see it in more of a technical sense than perhaps evil as we sometimes think of it. So basically we have our own will. Now, on top of that will, as we grow, we develop a rational, sometimes called a first rational or a false rational. As we grow into adolescence, our innocence becomes patchy. Evil begins to show through. Through a love of learning, we acquire facts and cognitions which become irrational, so we can rise into the place of reason. But we can't stay there. Our own will continues to exert control over us. And so we have clear indications and obvious evidence that as a child begins to grow, there is a desire for learning within them. It's an insatiable desire. It's an addiction almost to them, this desire to learn. And this is, according to the writings, a very natural process that takes place. They begin, of course, with just an affection for everything, but as that desire for learning continues to get fulfilled in them, they move into a different stage. Now, this rational is actually connected to our will. It's not really distinct. And that'll become important when we look at the books of Matthew, and it should say Mark there on your sheet, not Matthew and Luke. So then, from that rational grows a spiritual. When we come to a place where we're able to be regenerated, into that rational, which is basically, now what is the rational? The rational is essentially a desire to draw truths into ourself from the world around us, to gather together facts and what we call, what the writings call cognitions, or that is the facts that we, that bring us, facts that we believe from experience. We have experienced that they are true. We don't just believe them because we're told, but we believe them because we have experienced them to be true. So there is this rational that we gather together. And then into that rational, when we come to a place where we can be open to spiritual things, a true rational is implanted. Now this is heavy stuff. Essentially, what I'm giving you is the spiritual sense of the story of Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and Isaac, as it's covered in the book of Genesis. Ishmael was not the child of the promise. Ishmael was the child that Abraham decided to have. And Ishmael represents that first rational. When the child of the promise, when God's promise was fulfilled to Abraham, the true child of the promise was born, that's Isaac. And Isaac represents that blossoming spirituality. But, having said that, it's a spirituality based in our understanding. So we have a will here, then we have a natural understanding, then we have a spiritual understanding. That comes about because of that. Finally, good is implanted into the truths of the spiritual, and this becomes the new will. So we must first learn truth, but the truth must be confirmed by love. Over time, this new will becomes dominant and brings the spiritual and rational into submission. So we develop this rational, which comes out of our evil will and which is tied to our evil will. And this is an interesting truth to know. For a long time, I would come across people who, you know, I would talk to about various issues, about various stuff going on in their life. And then they would share about all of these things that they were doing or going to do or trying to do. And then I get to know them a bit better and I realize that they were failing at those things. But the intentions were good. The desire to do those things was very real. It's just that they couldn't do them. And the writings give the explanation for this, in that this rational is still under the authority of our natural human will, of our propria. It's only when the Lord implants a new rational, a spiritual, into the rational that we already have, a process of regeneration begins to take place, that we get to the stage where there's a hope of overcoming the power and the authority of the will that we are born with. And then it's only when that spiritual rational begins to be formed within us that into that a new will can be implanted. So this is quite critical to the New Church teaching, to an understanding of the writings. In the New Church, we make a big emphasis on the Word. It's vitally, it's very important. It's something that, if you spend any time in the New Church at all, you begin to realize is something that's talked about and thought about a lot. Now, the reason for that is because our access to God through the new will is not direct. It's indirect. It has to come through our understanding. And it is the Word that enables us to create this understanding, which gives us access to our new will, which ultimately is access to God. So we can describe it this way. The evil will and the rational is a part of our natural man, our unspiritual self. The spiritual then is implanted into that rational. It is separate from it. It's like grafting a fruit tree into a wild stock. Anybody who knows anything about gardening and grafting knows that we take a wild stock because it's hardy, resistant to disease, it's able to grow in almost any soil, and then we plant the fruit that we want into that stock. And that's a very good illustration of what's happening here. That spiritual is separate, but implanted into that rational will. And then the spiritual creates then a container into which the celestial can then also be implanted. And so we can regard these two as a one, but these two are separate, in a sense, from each other. And they're separated by a what we call a discrete degree. And they seem together, but they're actually not. They're actually separate. Now, the problem with that previous diagram is that it doesn't show the way that the will and the understanding, the affection and the thought, need to be a one. They need to be combined together, like a man and a woman. So we have, in this diagram, we have the idea of the natural will and understanding and the spiritual will and understanding. And intriguingly, when you look at it like that, you begin to see the idea of this separation here between the natural and the spiritual, and also a separation here between the will and the understanding. And it's interesting, that separation, because as you can see from my extending the line down there, it's a symbol. It has a very interesting symbol. Now, we don't use the symbol of the cross in the New Church because we don't believe a lot of the theology of the traditional Christian church about Jesus dying for our sins and all that sort of stuff. We understand it quite differently. But that doesn't mean necessarily that the cross doesn't have significance. And in this situation, you can see that it does. There is quite a strong significance there.
Excuse me, Matt, is there a reason this Western spiritual is switched? I mean, in my mind,
I'm getting to that. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm getting to that. Yeah, that's all right. So all we have to do then to then understand Mary Horton's new way of looking at the Gospels is to substitute the Gospel names for the spiritual degrees that we had before. So most of us who've had a look at the Bible in any clear sense understand that the Gospel of John is different from any other Gospel. In fact, theologians tell us that these three Gospels are known as the Synoptic Gospels. And the Gospel of John is... has it got its own name?
Gospel of John.
Yeah, I can't remember. But it's just different.
Standalone.
It's quite different from the other three. Okay. And this is because it's the Gospel of the Celestial, or the same saying, the same thing, the Gospel of Love. Okay. Now, Mary B. Horton goes one step further. She draws into that image there of the four a swastika. Now, before you get really upset, Mary B. Horton wrote her book in 1891. Okay. And the swastika did not have any of the dreadful connotations that it has today. But the interesting thing about this image is that it has what we call an ascending and descending degree. And those, of course, are words that the writings use. We see that this is an ascending degree from the old will to the new. What we don't realize is that there is a simultaneous descending degree from the new will to the old. Because who is it that inspires the ascending of this, in this sense, from the old will up? It's the Lord. It is the Lord that inspires us to regenerate. And in fact, if we look at once again at the story of Abraham and Isaac, Abraham represents God. God reaching down and inspiring within us to reach up to Him. The motivation always comes from above. And people have already spoken about that to some degree. So we can see then that in this swastika image, we not only have the idea of the will and understanding and in a partnership, but we have an idea of a rotating process going on. And this is not a lot of people might think that the swastika is a very modern image, but in fact the swastika goes way, way, way back in time. The number four has all sorts of significance. It's possible that the cross is a modern representation of a far older symbol indicating good fortune and blessing, or reformation and regeneration. This is a picture of a swastika in a Greek jar from almost 700 BC. So you can see that we're not dealing with a modern image. This is a Japanese map. See, these swastikas here represent what they've always represented, which is Japanese places of worship. This is a picture of the Buddha, as you can see. And of course, the Buddha has the number four, Four Noble Truths. And also we notice the swastika. And this is from India. This is Hinduism. And Hinduism also has four goals of human endeavor, and also the swastika in there. And this goes right back in time. This is a Roman bronze brooch. Now, this is called the swastika stone. This is in England, as you can see, I'd be more in Yorkshire. But this is a bit interesting, because this swastika is in a more rounded form. It's normally called the fly fot. But it is still regarded by archaeologists as a swastika. And there are many examples in very, very, very ancient man of this image. Now, my presentation was going to finish at that point, but then after I'd been thinking about it for a couple of weeks, I suddenly thought to myself, well, that looks remarkably like something else. And it's just my intuition speaking, but that something else is that image there. So you can see that this idea that I'm talking about, the number four and the process of reformation and regeneration, is something that I believe, and certainly Mary B. Horton believes, is very, very, very old. In fact, it goes all the way back to the beginning of human spirituality and experience. And it has been attempted to be represented in many, many ways. So, what I want you to do now is I want you to take off your top page, and underneath you will find a set of the four Gospels. And these four Gospels are dealing, each of them is a different chapter, but the chapters are all talking about the same incident. And the incident, basically, is Jesus' crucifixion. The period of Jesus' crucifixion. And I want to see if we can see, to some degree, this process of the natural will, the natural understanding, the spiritual understanding, and the spiritual will happening there. So, let's look at the two robbers. In Matthew 27, verse 38, it says two robbers were crucified with him, with Jesus. Now, if we look at a similar verse in Luke 32, verse 2, it doesn't call the robbers anymore, but it calls them a lesser, less incriminating, if you like, name of two criminals, or a bit like you'd call a crime and a misdemeanor. So they are regarded then as, Luke regards them as not quite as bad as they are regarded in Matthew and Mark. And you could see there, in the natural will and understanding, there is greater condemnation than in the beginning of the spiritual understanding, which is Luke. Finally, in John, verse 18, they are referenced as just two others. Jesus was nailed to the cross with two others. No value judgments being made at all, because this is the gospel of love. Let's look at another incident. In Matthew 27, verse 46, Jesus is recorded that great statement, my God, why have you forsaken me? His final words on the cross. Both in Matthew and Mark, this same similar statement is made. But in Luke chapter 23, verse 46, you'll find Jesus says something different. He says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. So Jesus moves from a place of what we might call rage against injustice to a place of acceptance. Now, if we look in John, I haven't got the verse for that, unfortunately. Jesus says, not even my Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, but simply, it is finished. It's finished. Verse 30, thank you. So there's a level of acceptance there. There's a level of, if you like, transcendence taking place there, which is what you would expect if John is the gospel that represents the new will. Let's keep going. Matthew 27, verse 37, the sign above Jesus reads, this is Jesus, King of the Jews. In Mark and Luke, the sign also says, King of the Jews. But in John, it says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Now, this is interesting because in Matthew, which is the old will, the name Jesus is used. Does anyone know what Jesus represents? Jesus Christ. We use the name Jesus Christ because it has good and truth. Which is which?
Jesus
is good. Christ is truth. Okay? So in Matthew, which is to do with the old will, we have the good of God mentioned in Jesus. In John, which is to do with the new will, we also have Jesus represented. In Matthew and Mark, which lie between, which have to do with the understanding, we have King of the Jews, which is associated with truth. Let's go on. Pilate's question. In the first three Gospels, Pilate asks the question, are you the King of the Jews? And Jesus' answer is, as you say. That's all he says. But in John 14, he says, here is your King. So there's no longer a question there. There's just an acceptance. Here is the King. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus' reply to Pilate is, as you say. But in John, chapter 19, verse 11, Jesus replies to Pilate. He says, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. So we see in this not only a transcendence, but a releasing to Pilate of any condemnation that he might feel. So we have both things combined in the answer that we're given in that gospel. In Matthew verse 19, we have a situation where Pilate's wife, the only mention that's made of it in any of the gospels, has a dream and warns Pilate about dealing with Jesus because of her dream. Now, we know that dreams have to do with the reality that we live, as it were, in the old will. We are living in a dream. It is like an unconscious state. It is like a dream state. So it's understandable why that comment would exist only in Matthew, which is the old will.
Can I share one I just spotted?
Yeah.
Matthew, Mark, Luke refer to Barabbas. John does not. I wasn't aware of that. But there's no reference to the choice. And it's not a choice, it's actually a love action, you see. That's the sort of idea I'm getting. But Barabbas means, fascinatingly, the son of the father. Bar-Abbas, Abba, son of the father. And Jesus is the son of God. So you get this choice in Matthew, Mark, Luke. Which are you going to choose? The son or the offspring of your heritage, or the son of the living God? And they demand Barabbas.
So you can see in this a sense that Matthew and Mark are looking upwards from a place somewhat similar to from a place of selfishness, as Core said. It's a little bit similar to some of the psychology of people like Erickson, who talk about how we move as human beings from a place of intense self-centeredness, intense selfishness as children, to a place of more universality, a place, well, not everybody does, but ideally we move to a place where we transcend racism and we transcend prejudice and we transcend these, and these are stages of human development that many psychiatrists and philosophers have come up with. And I believe that you can see these stages just listening to what what's your name?
Julian.
Oh, sorry.
Anyway, we could see that from looking upward, Matthew and Mark looking upward from a self-centered, from a selfish position, and John and Luke are more looking downward from a place of transcendence, from a place of generosity, from a place of love. Any questions? I have a couple more. Do you want me to read through the last few that I've got, or do you want to ask a question?
No, you read, darling. Let's
okay. I'll finish it up. Let's have it. The robe in Matthew is scarlet. In Mark, the robe is purple. And in Luke, the robe is called elegant. Verse 11 is called elegant. Now, interestingly enough, and I don't actually have an explanation for this, in John, the robe is also called purple.
Yeah.
Okay, so, what was
Matthew? Mm-hmm.
Scarlet.
Matthew is scarlet.
So, red is will.
Mm-hmm. John is, Mark is purple.
Which is blue and red together, which is will and understanding.
Yep. Luke is elegant. Or sometimes it's translated shining.
Yeah, adornment or shining is understanding.
So why is John also purple?
It's also American good and truth. Union good and truth.
Which actually...
Red and... What is it? Blue and blue and red, yeah.
Which actually touches very well on this idea that it's John and Mark which are the... I'll use the word... special, exciting gospels. We know why John is. We know why John is, because there's so much love and God and eternity. But Mark is actually the same thing, grounded, so it's the celestial right down, and it's got this purple, blue and red in both of them, which is a
and of course, purple
a union.
Purple is the colour of royalty as well, of course. Okay. The crown of thorns. There's no crown of thorns mentioned in Luke. Sorry. But in Matthew and Mark, it's recorded as being handmade. twisted together. There's no, I believe there's no crown of thorns mentioned in John either.
Yes.
Verse 5. Mock worship. In Matthew 29 and Mark 19, mock worship is talked about. In relation to that, also in Matthew 29, they put a staff in his right hand in Matthew, but in Mark, they struck him in the head with a staff. In Luke and John, there's no staff. Staff means power, the power of the will, which is contradiction. Really, it's taking power into your own hands. In the first three Gospels, Simon helps Jesus carry the cross. In John, Jesus carries it alone. Because, of course, ultimately all the work is done by God. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they cast lots for his clothes. In John, they simply divide them amongst each other. In Matthew, Mark, and John, they offer him wine on a stick. In Luke, there's no stick. That's not mentioned. In Matthew and Mark, women are mentioned. In Luke and John, women are also mentioned, but there is a conversation, an interaction that goes on with the women and Jesus in both of those two Gospels. So we can see this is the idea that Mary Horton has, you know, attempted to use to explain why there is four Gospels
and the differences between them.
And the interesting thing, as I pointed out earlier, is that the old will and the natural understanding are very closely tied together. They're almost indistinguishable. They virtually act as a one. And the books of Matthew and Mark are also very, there's very little difference between them. Whereas the true understanding of Luke and the new will of John stand completely on their own. They're not regarded as being taken from a similar source or from each other, like Matthew and Mark do. Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about Mary Horton?
Not that much more. Mary Horton lived in America. She's American. She's a member, obviously, of the convention, because I don't believe the General Church existed at that stage. She basically, I think, wrote this book. She was typical of a lot of American women. She wasn't given a great deal of credibility within the church, but she just had this very strong insight and desire to, put it forward.
The ideas that she's come up with in looking at the differences between Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, how does the church in general regard her work? Any idea?
They ignore her, basically. Mm. When I was in Bryn Athyn, I asked a number of people whether they'd heard of her or, you know, known of her, and almost nobody did. I went and one of the ministers there took me to the library and we looked up and found that they did have two copies of her book in the library, but he hadn't heard of her.
Can I just add to this? just working with Mary B. Horton, I read Mary B. Horton and then did my own research into the four Gospels. And another way of holding it, which I found useful in terms of seeing that the Gospels are connected just has to do with an overall general kind of style to each of them, I suppose. But in Matthew's Gospel, what you have is a lot of looking back. So Matthew is like our a stage of faith, a historical stage of our faith, you know, like, so in Matthew's Gospel, you get Jesus saying things like, you know,
as of old,
you know, you've heard it this way, I'm telling you, that's right. And so what you have in Matthew is a lot of reference back to the Old Testament. And so it's like an early stage of learning where we've built up this knowledge. And but it's just sort of at the level of the memory. And then when you move, so looking at it in a linear kind of way, when you move into Mark's Gospel, Mark's Gospel starts with Jesus as 30 years old or whatever it is. It starts with him in ministry. And Mark's Gospel has an immediacy to it. So it's like, you know, it's all action. It's doing. And so it's the way I view it, it's like Mark is like taking what you've learnt, which is represented by Matthew, and actually trying to live it, right? And that's why you get this kind of immediacy and movement through Mark's Gospel. And then when you come to Luke's Gospel, Luke means light, enlightenment, if you like, the name Luke, which is interesting in itself. But it's like anything, you know, if you are an apprentice and you're sort of going through TAFE and what have you, you're getting your knowledge in Matthew, right? Mark is like putting it into action. And then Luke is like the insights that come from that activity. And so what you get with Luke, it starts off, it's written to this guy called Theophilus, which means friend of God. And what Luke says is, look, you've heard this story, but here it is again. And I'm going to tell you it fully as it's, you know, to be understood. And so, like, Luke is like a retelling or an increased in understanding that's arisen out of practicing what you know. And then, of course, you get John's Gospel. And John's Gospel is the supreme insight that the Lord is the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Like there's a marked shift that occurs if you see the Gospels.
It's like pushing up Matthew, Mark, Luke as far as you can get, and the breakthrough.
This is John coming down, and Revelation is the outworking. The Book of Revelation is kind of the outworking of that.
No, not the Book of Revelation. You get John revealing
who Jesus
down,
is. Yeah.
Who Jesus is, because you pushed up.
Yeah, in terms of the canon.
You've done the work.
Then you get ultimately John as the revelator.
Yes.
And that's that realization actually reforming the whole and regenerating the whole human mind in accordance with that revelation. So So they are linked, and the differences. You know, I don't know if people have seen, like, you can actually get a synopsis of the Gospels.
Harmony.
Harmony of the Gospels, yeah.
Try and get one that is four. The usual one used to be a harmony of the Synoptic Gospels, but you can actually get four.
Yeah, and each page gives you the passages that, so like, you know, you get your four on a single page across, and you can sort of look.
Columns,
yeah. And so you can look and see the differences.
Yeah. Bishop de Chalmers has done this.
That's the harmony. No, this is a different kind of work. Well, it's just scripture for a start, and that's really helpful, seeing them laid across next to each other.
In the Chalmers book?
He does that.
He does, well, like, it's just at the end. So it's not all written out, but he has them all laid up. So you could look in a Bible.
Okay.
It's like in a table form. Right. He does that as well as puts them together chronologically.
Katie, maybe.
Just coming back to the symbol of the cross, okay, not that I don't want learning much. And going back to Julian, ancient. Are you with us, Julian? You're staring. Okay. That beginning of language, I first heard, and this is nearly 30 years ago, okay, at one of the first retreats I made then, that the cross was an ego with the line through it. I'm sure you've heard that. But also, when what you were talking about there of, I'd never thought of it as, you know, the growth, the journey of growth, and someone described the cross as the collision of opposites. And that would be, wouldn't it? The journey actually is a cross, otherwise we wouldn't be asked to pick it up each day.
In the sense that the journey is reformation and regeneration, or yeah, but regeneration.
That is, there's a price. Everything has a price. Mm.
It's also going our way and discovering that there is another way that life is actually happening. Is it, that makes sense? So the two fuse into one symbol.
So can I just ask, because I don't know, do you actually not do like the Passion Death of Good Friday, Swedenborg Church, I mean, new church, because you don't go along with the cross?
No. Sorry, Martin.
Martin.
Who are you asking, Katie?
Martin.
I'll just pass it over to you.
The traditional teaching of the crucifixion is Jesus died for our sins. So man was sinful and evil, so sinful and evil that God could not face him, God couldn't have any contact with him. So then Jesus was born, and Jesus died and took the punishment that we deserved from God on himself. And that was the crucifixion. And I believe that that's the Catholic belief as well. Now, in the new church, we understand that nobody can take any punishment for anybody else. We have to deal with our own, and it's not even about punishment, because we're not interested in the God of punishment, because we don't believe that God is about punishment. No. He's about love. And thirdly, the idea of Jesus is acting as a sacrifice for us, which is based loosely on a misunderstanding of the Old Testament sacrifices, which were not really sacrifices, they were love offerings. The idea of a sacrifice actually drives a wedge between the Father and the Son, which doesn't work, because the Father and the Son were one person and not two people. One. You can't drive a wedge between them. I can't drive a wedge between Julian and Julian. Mm-hmm. Can't be done. Okay, so it defies.
The original word for Father and Son, which has become split persons, the original word for Father and Son, I believe, means what is the source and what comes from offspring, you know. It's more in that abstract sense rather than Jesus saying, oh, Father God, let me go down and deal with it on their behalf and on your behalf. Oh, yes, go. And you get this committee thing.
Yeah, it takes a... Sorry. To me, having a traditional outlook on the cross takes all the responsibility away from us. And then you get this God as a superhero, you know, kind of representation. That, you know, by saving by faith alone, because I don't need to do anything, there's nothing I can do because, oh, woe is me, because...
Except believe it.
Except believe that I'm bad and, you know, I'll be saved. But I don't need to do anything else. So that requires things like that, is because we identify with it ourselves as that, well, if we're so bad, somebody's got to give, somebody's got to be punished, and, you know, if somebody else does something bad to us, you know, somebody's got to be punished kind of thing. Well, it's totally different. The cross is just a culmination, a finished completion of the process. So the new church looks at the Lord's coming and the whole process of growing up in its entirety as being of extreme importance, mimicking, well, we're actually mimicking that process, you know. And because he's gone through that process and is allowing the rest of humanity to be able to go through that process in freedom. So he's carved a path for us to follow in terms of spiritual regeneration. Get freedom where we restart. Well, it goes a bit far. I don't want to go into it. Rather than just at one point in time that's why he came. No, it came because of the whole process, and that was just the end of it. There's no need. That was completed. It's finished.
Yeah. So Jesus basically took on that regeneration process like we have to go through, but he did it perfectly. He gained a natural understanding, and then into that natural understanding was implanted a spiritual understanding, and then into that spiritual understanding was implanted a new will. Jesus took on that process, and in the process reordered the spiritual world.
So it takes
about 10-15 minutes. So that we could, our efforts to undertake that process,
and does it again and again and again, ongoingly. He does that act in us as we respond into it. So he gives of himself. So the Passion story is not a one-off, it's a multiplicity.
So what would have happened if Jesus hadn't have come? You're saying he had to reorder it.
Well, what was the world like before Jesus came?
Complete chaos.
Essentially, those two, that first rational and second rational, were a chaotic mess.
There was no path
there was we no could follow path through it. Yeah.
To the higher. Yeah. And he recreated, he opened up that path again.
He reordered it. But he didn't reorder it in our minds. He reordered it in the spiritual world, which also reordered it in our minds. Because we are suspended between intellect, in our will, in our intellect, in every part of us. We are in a relationship with heaven and hell.
If you believe in divine providence, I think that's where I'm coming from. How could the Lord possibly allow that pathway to be obliterated?
By creation being done in the way in which it was done and had to be done, so that we are free individuals. Mm-hmm. Part of the outcome of that is the risk of us losing the connection. Sort of in a historical sequence idea, as well as in a personal way, and God having to do something at all costs to finally prevent that total loss, for want of a better phrase, from being reached. And it will always be that way, so that temptation, or maybe that's not the best analysis.
Well, can I say
ignorance or rejection on our part can go to the nth degree, but it cannot go to the 100%. You can say why not, but it cannot get to that point where there is no redemption possibility.
Aren't you just saying that it did reach that point? So therefore he had to send Jesus to reopen it? Isn't it you're saying getting to the 100% was total chaos?
No, it wasn't at 100%. The lights were going out, in one sense, as darkness...
It was reaching the 100%.
It was, you know, it's the acid tone, you know? The ever-approaching line.
It's the critical point that there is no resurrection without a death.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it a little bit differently, and then I look at it in that last symbol that I put up there, the yin and yang, essentially can be summed up as saying you cannot appreciate good until you have experienced evil. And there's that constant process in life of experiencing the bad and then appreciating more the good. So we talk about the fall as being a terrible thing. It was a terrible thing. But in a sense, when we were so devoted to God that there was no shadow at all of evil in us, that wasn't enough for God. He wanted to go one step further than that. And he wanted to see what would happen when we were faced, we were given an opportunity to choose differently. Would we come back to him? Now, he then had to enter into the world because we ultimately created chaos of that and reordered it. But what we're still experiencing that process of coming back to God from, as it were, our own choice, which could be seen, could be understood as being a greater depth of God's love, because we're coming back from further down than when it was easy to love God. Originally, our natural will was able to, and this is something that it took me a long time to understand. Originally, our natural will was able to reach God through our celestial will. There was no break, and the understandings were like a pure line of communication all the way up. And sometimes we still think in terms of that, especially because we don't want to deal with evil and sin. But the reality is that evil and sin distorted that. And that's why a new way had to be developed. And that way was through the Word, which came into our understanding, and then through that enabled us to reach God.
Okay.
I'm going to stop there, or we're going all up.
I'm just going to add one. It's all about connection and our ability to receive from the Lord his love and wisdom. And so in the Old Testament, it got down to the point where it was a representative religion. And so what those ideas do is that as those ideas, through that representation, are present in the mind, so heaven can be supported. So there's a connection all the way down. Now what happened, so the Lord's life really is an example of how we treat the word, truths. And what had happened was that the crucifixion represents what we do with truth when we want our own ideas to rule over it. And that breaks the connection. The Lord cannot get to us other than by presenting himself in a way. So what happened with the life of the Lord is that, you know, those who didn't see him as God in the end saw him crucified, right? Those who believed him to be God saw him resurrected. And so it just represents the two. So there was a re-establishment of a connection. And the person of Jesus lived out that love and wisdom in a
in a very physical kind of way. And so whereas prior to that, because of all the false ideas about love and about who God is, you know, like for even for the Jews, you know, God was this punitive tyrant, essentially. And that idea stops love and wisdom coming through from an internal way. It blocks off the light. And so the Lord presenting as a human being was able to live out what love and wisdom actually is. And that set a new ground on the lowest level of consciousness, with which is now recorded here, so that anybody who reads about the Lord and what he did can form a truer idea of God, which enables the Lord to be present from it by an inward way and lift them out of that. And that's our salvation taking place.
It's all about the word.
And I would say that, I think David yesterday said that the word as we have it is a kind of supreme expression of it. But I have to believe that all people are given and provided with internally and culturally and society requirements enough sense of goodness in life so that they will never ever lose the plot. It might take many, many, many forms. The word is supremely expressive, but I think it's there in nature, it's there in the Bhagavad Gita, it's there in rational thought, it's there in something planted in us and so on, so that no person whatsoever does not have that link. Otherwise, God is cruel if that isn't the case.
I think that perhaps because we did not live in the pre-Christian era makes it a little bit difficult to totally comprehend the state of the world at that point. We can read about it, but perhaps doesn't mean as much to us as it. We need to comprehend the need, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it raises the old questions of, you know, how did God save people before he came down and did what he did, you know? How did he do that, you know? Poor sods, they lived 100 years too early, sort of thing, you know?
Ignorance.
Yes.
Can I just introduce the two people I walked in? We've got two more locals. John is here.